Ani Nindawe Magadanda Kalo, my relatives. Thank you very much for the honor of being here with you today. Bine Sikwe and Jinakas, Makwendo Deum, Gababani Kog, Ishkaniganing and Dunjaba. I'm from the White Earth Reservation, I'm Bear Clan, and I'm really honored to be here with you. You asked me to speak about the idea of being good ancestors. And, you know, as I think about this moment in time and who we are, we got a pretty good gig. You know, I live in a place where you can still drink the water from a lake. I live in a place where you can get sugar from a tree. Wild rice is in abundance. I live in a place that we have a good life that the Creator gave us. And I would like to keep that covenant, that covenant. That's how I think of it and how I think we are instructed, is that we have this agreement with the Creator and the natural world to do our part, you know, to do our part and to be good humans. And so this lecture is a little bit about that and the conundrum we got ourselves into and how we're going to get ourselves out from my perspective. But as I start, this art piece here is done by an artist named Votan, and this is a water protector. I'm a water protector. This art is in downtown Duluth in a city that is known for the missing and murdered indigenous women, as is much of Montana and North Dakota. And, you know, we're invisible in a lot of cities. I know that because I am one of those women. And I also know the number of us that each of our families, many of our families are affected by this, my family as well. We have lost our women in this way. But this woman is not invisible. She's about 40 feet wide and 60 feet tall. And she's on 2nd Street and 2nd Avenue in downtown Duluth. She is beautiful and she is a water protector. This is where I live, Gawawiegamug. I live, you know, in the middle of my reservation. And I think about this month in Anishinaabe Moan, and this month is called Namebenegesis, which means the sucker moon. And then it's followed by a moon that is known as Onabanegesis, which is the hard-crusted snow moon. Y'all know what I'm saying, like freeze, thaw. Yeah, y'all from, right, yeah. Also, the moon, you don't want to do a face plant in the snow. Iskigam is a gigizis, is our maple syruping moon. And then the moon that follows that is our Wabaganagizis, our flower moon, Odeminagizis, our strawberry moon, Meangizis, our blueberry moon, Manominakegizis, our wild rice-making moon. Then we have our Watebaga Gizis when the leaves change color, Binaquio Gizis when they fall. Gashkadnu Gizis, that's around November. That's the freezing over moon. Probably a similar ecosystem to all of you, yeah? So those are some of the names and the moons in our language. Manadu Gizis, Suns, Gitchi Manadu Gizis. I thought you might like to hear my language. It's related to Blackfeet, actually. Did you notice that none of those moons is named after a Roman emperor? Did y'all get that? So I just want to say it is possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire. You'd be okay. Just let some of that stuff go. It's way too many bags to carry around. So this is some of our art from our territory, and I was gifted with a really beautiful piece of this art today by Jason Clark, who's here at the university. But I like to show this art because, as many of you know, I was an undergraduate at Harvard University, and if you wanted to study the art from Europe, you went to the fine arts department, and if you wanted to study indigenous art, you went to anthropology. And so there is something about the valuation of art and knowledge in that that I think you need to like say out front, which is that indigenous knowledge is not valued the same as Western knowledge. And in this moment in time, I'm pretty clear that the paradigm that got us into this set of problems is not the paradigm that's going to get us out. You know, so it is really going to be important for all of us to kind of like take a breath and say, I'm going to let go of some stuff I don't need. And I'm going to figure out how to make things beautiful again. So this art shows kind of inside of the beings. It's called the X-ray vision, and it shows some of the relationship between the beings. The piece is called We Are All in the Same Boat. And it is true, because we all are. You know, at this moment in time, we are all collectively in this situation where we have this opportunity. In our teachings, this is called the time of the seventh fire. As Anishinaabe people, we are told that in this time, we would have a choice between two paths. One would be well-worn, but it would be scorched. And the other path would not be well-worn, and it would be green. And it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And I'm pretty sure that that's America's quandary. You know, what are we going to do? And we're the ones who are present and have this spiritual opportunity to make that choice. So I'm going to start with talking about making America great again. So this is my idea of when America was great. The 8,000 varieties of corn. You know, we was all pretty busy over here before everybody came over. A lot of agro-biodiversity. And I think about that because that's when America was great, is when there was 8,000 varieties of corn. America was great when there was, as well, 50 million buffalo. That'd be when America was great. Single largest migratory herd in the world, transformed ecosystems, and lived in a territory where there were 250 different species of grass. Tremendous biodiversity. You know, that is where life is in biodiversity. And today in this same landscape, you and I know that that does not exist. Thankfully, there are still the bison range, and I would like to see the control of that and the management of that returned to the Salish and Kootenai people. Because that is how America is going to get great, by returning some stuff that was taken. That's how you fix things. But, you know, in the same territory where there were once 50 million buffalo, there are today about 28 million cattle that require an entire fossil fuels economy to take care of them. And everybody here knows that a cow will flee a blizzard, will run from it, but a buffalo will walk into it. If you want to think of the animals that are going to survive in the time of climate change, you might look at those guys. So that's when America was great. America was great when the skies were blackened with passenger pigeons, when every river and lake you could drink from, and when the fish were in great abundance. That is when America was great. And I want to remember that, and I want to say I want it back. America suffers from a great deal of historical amnesia and also ecological amnesia. With the transience of Americans, people do not live in the same place as their grandparents or their great-grandparents, and they certainly have no idea of what was there. They don't remember that that was the place where the wild rice was, or maybe that was the place where the buffaloes were. And this is when America was great, and it still is. This is our wild rice. This is Nana Bujou and Acomas, a painting by an artist named Rabbit Strickland. But in our territory, we still have that wild rice. You know, there are two very different worldviews of how one should relate to this world. I refer to Wendigo economics, the economics of cannibalism. This is the time when we start discussing what that looks like. And to me, this is what it looks like. Where 50 million buffalo go in piles. One winter, 400,000 buffalo piled up there. I think that's Fort Dodge. And this is what happened. This is the signing of the Garrison Diversion Project Agreement. That's the tribal chairman there of the three affiliated tribes weeping as all of that land, and everyone in Montana knows that, or I hope that you do, is that almost every Indian reservation has a pretty good sized dam on it. And those dams were not for us. You know, the relationship, instead of a covenant, the relationship of a constant level of consumption and a constant level of extraction. You know, and so in the moment of time where we are, it's not going so great. This is a picture from Fort McMurray, which is up in the middle of the tar sands, and this was a fire that they had 2 years ago that, I don't know if you saw that fire, but there was smoke from those fires in Ontario and in Alberta in northern Minnesota. And some days you would wake up and it would be a red sky. But this could have been the entire west coast of the United States. This could have been the Camp Fire. I was talking a little bit about infrastructure earlier. Munich Re, the world's largest reinsuring company, suggested that by 2020, we would be spending 20% of world GNP on climate change-related disasters. Now, they might have been a little high or a little low. I have no idea. But all I know is that no one has a plan for this one. When the reality is that around us, the decisions that have been made in this economy that has consumed more than it needs and has been highly extractive, we have no plan collectively on how we're going to survive this next stage. You know, at this moment in time, as I talked about the scorched path or the green path, I am with all of you. I've spent my entire life in the fossil fuel era, whole life. You know, I've had a great time. Did y'all have a pretty good time? It's okay. Admit it. It's been a blast. Went to drive-ins. I flew around. Remember drive-in movies, you know? Sometimes I get my flowers from Colombia 2 days after they are picked. I like to eat my goji berries from the Himalayas or something. You know, so my point is that, you know, we live in this period of time and I've enjoyed it. And what I'm really after is kind of a graceful transition out of it. In the big picture, we've entered this era where we've jacked our society up on fossil fuels. Each of our households is consuming a vast amount, and most of our lifestyles are predicated on access to cheap fossil fuels. We've become addicted. That's the reality. We're all addicts. And the thing with addicts is that addicts do a lot of bad stuff. Some of you probably have addicts in your family, and we, you know, rationalize, and they lie, and they, in some ways, your problem. And we've entered this era, which Montana is well into, which is an era known as extreme extraction, which means that you're kind of at the bottom of the barrel. So everything that's out there to get is, like, not easy. There's not oil just, like, gushing anymore. So extreme extraction, lopping off the top of 500 mountains in Appalachia. That's some extreme behavior. And that's not even for coal for this country. That's coal that's being exported, right? Extreme behavior, extreme extraction is drilling 20,000 feet under the ocean because you can and hoping that that's going to work out for you, right? Until you get the Deepwater Horizon. Extreme extraction is blowing up the bedrock of Mother Earth, shoving 602 chemicals down there, and hoping what goes down will not come up. Fracking. Right? Bottom of the barrel. Extreme extraction is tar sands. Dirtiest oil in the world. And at a certain point, you gotta say, how bad's your habit? I wanna be one of the people that says, we didn't leave the Stone Age because we ran out of rocks. You know, we're gonna leave the fossil fuel era because it's time. So this is a little bit about what that looks like, the bigger social picture of it. This is from North Dakota. You know, we refer to North Dakota as the Deep North, and actually part of Montana is the Deep North, too. Sex trafficking and missing women, you know, huge amounts of racism. And this, did anybody ever see this movie called Welcome to Leith, which is about this neo-Nazi town in North Dakota? This guy bought this town because people leave these rural areas. Everybody knows that. And so these Nazis bought this town, and they had their little neo-Nazi colony there, Leith. So these Lakota women, that would be Madonna Thunderhawk going like this, and then her sister, Mabel Ann Chasing Hawk, is behind her, and that other sister there, his name is Phyllis Young. I used to work for these women, and they were scary when I was 17, and they're still scary now. They stole the flag from that town of Leith. And then they burned the flag. So I just want to say, it's like, you can have some dumb ideas, but someone's going to say something about them. So I wouldn't want to quarrel with those women, still. I spent the last 5 years fighting pipelines. I didn't grow up and say, I want to fight pipelines. This is not my plan. My plan was to continue wild rice harvesting, grow organic food, and build a renewable energy economy. That's a good one, huh? Yeah, that seemed pretty good, you know. And then one day they announced this proposal to put this big pipeline across our territory. And this pipeline was called the Sandpiper. And it was a fracked oil pipeline out of North Dakota. And they announced that pipeline's going to come in across our territory. And you can see my reservation, White Earth, which is where that line is supposed to go. And they announced it, and I said, that's not going to work out. You know, and so I go and I start studying up on pipelines. And I'm actually not opposed to pipelines. I really like water and sewer. You know what I'm saying? It's like not the pipe, it's what's in it is the problem. Right? And we have in this country, as most people know, like crumbling infrastructure. And one of the things is that rather than fix old infrastructure, they just want to put in brand new infrastructure for oil companies. And that's my problem, is I want pipelines for people, not for oil companies. Right? That's kind of how I'm thinking about it. So, we go get ourselves educated about it and learn a lot about it. And then we started informing our own community. And then we started informing the non-Indian people in our area, like, about this pipeline project coming in. And my theory was as if you could get the Norwegians mad. You know, they're like a persistent, plucky bunch, you know. And they were like... So we built a multiracial alliance with a lot of Norwegians and Swedes. And we showed up at every hearing. And then filed a lawsuit after like mass, you know, we had a lot of ceremonies and a lot of civic participation. And then this lawsuit was filed by this little group called Friends of the Headwaters. And that lawsuit said to the state of Minnesota that you should do an environmental impact statement on the proposed 640,000 barrel a day pipeline. You shouldn't just like let them do it. So we had to sue them to get them to do an EIS. To me, I'd like the system to work. And so we had to sue them, and then they appealed that. Finally, the appeals court ordered them to do an environmental impact statement on this proposed pipeline project called the Sandpiper. So that was like 2.5, 3 years in, battling away. And just after they started that EIS on that process, the Enbridge Corporation canceled the Sandpiper. They canceled the pipeline. So what I want to say is it is possible to defeat a big pipeline project. 2016, we defeated the Enbridge Corporation, third largest corporation in Canada and the biggest pipeline company. And then what that company did is that company, the Enbridge Corporation, purchased 28% of the Dakota Access Pipeline, shored that up financially, and so we followed them out to North Dakota. It's not that far to Standing Rock from here. How many of you went out to Standing Rock? Oh, that's like so great. So people know what this was like out there. You know, so we follow them out there. Enbridge, we follow them out there, and this is what we saw. I didn't really understand what that equipment was until I had to ask someone, but the piece of equipment on the right is called an MRAP, Mine Resistant Armored Personnel Carrier. And so that is used in the military. And that, it says Stutzman County. And if anybody knows anything about Stutzman County might have 5,000 people in it. You know, they really have no need for an MRAP. That drives through a building, and there's not any buildings in Stutzman County. Y'all understand, it's like eastern Montana, so why you got something that looks like that, right? And the second piece of equipment there is called an LRAD, long-range acoustic device, and that's intended to blow your eardrums out. And so this is all what happens when you surplus military equipment to civilian police forces. And this is something that should not happen in this country. You should not be surplusing military equipment to civilian police forces so that they can protect corporations. And a lot of us who are at Standing Rock, it's really a moment of civil society. And this question to me of basically, should the rights of corporations supersede the rights of persons? Right. People in this room likely know that under the law, corporations are considered artificial persons under the law. They are bestowed with certain rights. So I've been thinking a lot about this. And if a corporation is a person, first of all, they aren't a person because a person has a soul. And a corporation does not have a soul. But if they want to be called a person, well, it seems to me like after you go through about 3 or 4 corporate mergers, you suffer from a multiple personality disorder. So you would not actually be competent in court to stand as a person. This is like my new argument on their argument. Plus, you're probably psychotic on top of that. This is one of the things we're gonna have to untangle, is the rights of humans versus the rights of corporations, and just the brutality that we experienced at Standing Rock. I did not sustain any injuries, and I was not arrested. But my family was arrested, and my family was injured, and I lost a horse at Standing Rock. I will never forgive North Dakota for the $38 million worth of military that they unleashed on me. As we face them again in Minnesota, as we face Enbridge, we have said, you are not bringing the tanks here because we will not stand for it. For many of us, Standing Rock was really a Selma moment in the environmental movement. This moment where all of your mettle and determination is tested as you face down large multinational corporations with lots of guns. And you say, we're still standing. You know, we're still standing. When Trump came in and approved that pipeline, which is wrong, this company came back to us, Enbridge, and they announced Line 3, which is a tar sands pipeline of 915,000 barrels a day. And we have been facing them now for 6 years. We are battling them in the courts, and we are battling them in the regulatory system in the United States. But if you missed your opportunity to go to Standing Rock, if they issue the rest of those permits and move ahead this summer, camping in Minnesota is very nice. And this is the line that they are proposing. Half of the proposed pipeline in northern Minnesota, the Enbridge line, tar sands pipeline that we are fighting, half of that line is on public land, and none of that line is built. My position is that I'm a member of the public, and I can camp for up to 14 days on public land. And camping is nice in Minnesota. You can camp right by a lake on the pipeline that they will not build. But this is our larger battle. And just in the last part of my what is wrong with the system, I just want to point this out to you, is this is a map of pipelines that are proposed in North America. This is because they are rebuilding the infrastructure of this country and of Canada, which is a pretty dysfunctional economy in itself. But if you look at this map, there were 5 pipelines proposed 2 years ago. And those 5 pipelines to get the landlocked tar sands, dirtiest oil in the world, out. First one, this one across the top, is called Energy East. That goes from Alberta to New Brunswick. The second pipeline was called Enbridge Northern Gateway. That's the third pipeline. It's called Trans Mountain. Fourth pipeline is the Keystone XL. And the fifth pipeline is Enbridge's Line 3. So that's just to give you a little picture of the North American tar sands pipeline battles. So, having said that, what I want to point out is that the Energy East pipeline, the longest pipeline, never received approval of the National Energy Board because the premier of none of those provinces nor the mayor of Montreal wanted that pipeline. So that pipeline never happened, and it's never going to happen. That second pipeline, the Northern Gateway pipeline of Enbridge, also did not happen. Huge opposition, not approved. So we're down to 3 pipelines. Y'all follow me on this? Dirtiest oil in the world. Third pipeline, Trans Mountain. Some of you know what happened with that pipeline. They're moving ahead with it. Canadian pipeline, but owned by a Texas company called Kinder Morgan. In August, the unrest, the civil disobedience, the arrests, and the opposition to that pipeline had grown so massively that they were not getting anywhere. And so Kinder Morgan said, you know, Canada, we want to back out a little bit because we don't feel confident about the social climate for this pipeline. I was like, no kidding. And then what happened, somebody might have noticed this, is that the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, panicked and he bought that pipeline, nationalized the pipeline, purchasing for $4.9 billion this pipeline known as the Trans Mountain Pipeline. I think we should just call it Trudeau West. So he spent $4.9 billion on a pipeline, and the day after he bought the pipeline, the Canadian Appeals Court ruled that all of the permits were null and void on that pipeline because they had not consulted with First Nations. So where are we at? 3 down, right? And that is in court. Canada's kind of in a big mess over that because spending $4.9 billion on something that isn't happening is expensive. Then Keystone, and we all know what Trump did. You know, he's just a little fairy wand, and he is like, I'm just going to reverse everything that Obama did because I'm president. And as you know, the Montana court said you can't just reverse things because you're president. You have to give a reason. So that is now in litigation here, right? Finally, that leaves one pipeline, right? Line 3. And that pipeline, that is our battle at home. We hope that the system works. If the system works, they will not ever approve this pipeline. If the system does not work, we'll be in a very brutal battle in Minnesota this summer. But as I said, camping in Minnesota will be really nice. And this is what it looks like in Minnesota on the ground. This is not North Dakota. This is thousands of people, 68,000 people testified against that pipeline in Bemidji, downtown Bemidji, as they started to amass the police forces to oppose us. A bunch of clergy joined together and blocked the streets. We all got arrested. There's my arrest photo. If you're going to get arrested, might as well just link yourself right up to a church person. Your sentencing will be a lot more lenient. So the story I'm telling you is keep at it. And you got a shot at stopping these lines and a lot of stupid projects. But more than that, the answers to me are found in the next economy. So I refer to this as the Sitting Bull Plan. Some people might refer to this as the Green New Deal, but I refer to this as the Sitting Bull Plan. And I think about that great leader who so long ago was a great political strategist, a spiritual leader, and a military strategist, but what he said is, let us put our minds together to see what kind of future we can make for our children. And that is what we really must do. If you want your future to be made for you by someone in Helena or somebody in Washington, D.C., you're probably going to be pretty disappointed with what they line out for you. If we are the people who are going to make our future, then no time like the present to begin thinking of what that looks like. So I refer to this as the Sitting Bull Plan. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what that looks like. You know, the next economy will be regenerative, it will be renewable, it will be organic. In my estimation, a lot of women should make more decisions. The last 200 years has been a lot of poor decision making. Renewable energy produces far more jobs per capita, per dollar, than do fossil fuels. In the other pictures of how that rolls out, I'm not sure how it worked out that Indian reservations are the windiest place in this country, but we are. And I think that anybody from Blackfeet knows that is true. Is that right? It's like, yeah, it looks really windy up there. But, you know, you guys have like class 7 wind, as does most of the northern plains. And that is the mark of an export economy, if you're looking at kind of the big picture of things, because, like, if you have 17,000 times more wind than you can use, you might want to share it. This is another example of what energy justice looks like, is that we're not the last people to get renewable energy in our communities. My friend Bob Goff used to say, you're either at the table or you're on the menu. I don't actually want to be just at the table. I want to set the table. And I want to figure out what we're eating. To me, this whole question of where we are going, we need to be very proactive in what that looks like and redefining the terrain. And so this is some work that I've just started looking at, which is railroads. A lot of reservations actually have railroads near them. But it is interesting, there's this group called the Solutionary Rail Project. And what they are looking at is electrifying railroads. Montana certainly has a lot of railroads, but we are the last country to have electrified trains. And just to give you an example of that, so if you think about it, the equivalent of the Marshall Plan being the Sitting Bull Plan, if you want to rebuild the infrastructure in this country, which we have a D in infrastructure, right? And so if we wanted to start working on that, you might as well do it well. One of the significant differences in how you move things is the difference between combustion and electricity. The engine in a car is only about 16% efficient. In the vehicle that most of us drove here in, a combustion engine is about 16% efficient. An electric engine is 65% efficient. You know, similarly, if you look at trains, 95% of the electricity that is generated if you had an electric train goes directly to the wheels, as opposed to 30% of it makes it to the wheels if you are running a diesel engine. One of the proposals that these guys have, the Solutionary Rail, is in electrifying the trains, and in electrifying these trains, actually using the rail lines as a way to transmit electricity, to have the power lines, right? Because you already have an energy corridor. I'm not the person to sort that out. I'm probably the person who's going to work on it on my reservation, because my reservation has one rail line that goes through three of our main villages and is very rarely used now, and my tribe should really look at both electrifying it and rebuilding the rail system so it works. Because everybody would probably prefer to have a rail system that works. We live in a country where I think the description by someone was that we have a rail system that would be an embarrassment to Bulgaria. Right? If we're going to be a first world country, let's be like classy first world country, not like what we got. So this is another example of how you make a change. This is a solar project on the Navajo Reservation. This is the Kayenta Solar Project. 13,000 homes are served off of this project. There's a huge amount of potential in a lot of our communities. Navajo has huge potential for renewable energy generation, particularly solar, and also has a huge amount of transmission lines that come from the 5 coal-fired generators that have been on the Navajo Reservation. And so potential to actualize it at a small scale and potential to actualize it at a much larger scale. But this is the Kayenta project. And there's a lot of work on putting solar on brownfields. And this is a project in the middle of the tar sands. This woman is named Melina Lubicon. She's a good friend of mine. And I was on her master's committee. at the University of Victoria a couple of years ago. And for her master's project, her village, Little Buffalo, just in the south side of the tar sands, surrounded by oil extraction, they didn't have electricity at their health clinic. What they had is a diesel generator to power their health clinic. And I just want to point that out because that's like a snapshot of what energy justice does not look like. When you are producing all this, have all the impacts in your community, have all the health impacts, and you don't even have power in your village, right? And so for her master's thesis, she didn't just talk about it, she put up 20 kilowatts of solar to power her health clinic. That's Melina Lubicon, really a gifted young woman. I was like, Melina, I'm going to try to do that too. And so this is 20 kilowatts of solar that powers a tribal school in my village. This is our village too. Here we are putting up solar thermal panels. Montana, this would work really well too. So on the south side of a house, it's super cold in Minnesota in the wintertime, but it's also sunny. And so within that, on the south-facing walls, you can install one of these panels, and that's a panel that's flat. It's about to go up into that space. And that panel, 4x8 panel, is dark inside, and so the sun comes into it, and when it hits about 90 degrees, the thermostat cranks on the blower fan, and it blows warm air into the house. In northern Minnesota and in the Dakotas, some of those places where they've had these panels, you can save about 20 to 30% of your heating bill if you have solar thermal. In the time of climate change, in the time when more of our grid will be going down, in the time where more and more people face fuel poverty, in the time when we don't know what's going to happen with the weather, you know, no time like the present to try to reduce some of the risk for your communities. This is like a really low-hanging fruit, and these things cost about, I don't know, $2,000 or so, and then the installation's probably another $1,000. And then this is work that we are doing in my community, growing back a lot of our old varieties. I want to say that I was an undergraduate at Harvard University, but my father went to school to the 8th grade, and he came to see me one day, and he's, you know, he's super proud of me, and he said, Winona, you're a really smart young woman, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. And so I became a corn grower at a certain point. But that was really interesting to say to a young woman who's studying so hard. Plants have taught me a great deal. So in the time of climate change and in the moment that we're in, it turns out that a lot of these old varieties are a lot more resilient. And so the variety that I grow mostly is this Bear Island Flint. And I received about this much from this plant geneticist, and I received it about 25 years ago. It was like a little handful had been collected on Bear Island and kept in the Grin Seed Bank, and they'd grown it out. And so now we have fields of it. And the first time I grew it, it was kind of short, and I thought I'd failed. Then I realized all it really had to do was to put on an ear. My corn varieties, you know, they're shorter, but it turns out that they were frost-resistant and they were drought-resistant. Also, when the big winds came through, they knocked over the 6-foot-tall Monsanto Roundup Ready varieties, but mine stood. So, twice the protein, half the calories. This is what you make hominy out of. So to me, the tremendous agrobiodiversity and the questions of food security. You know, the average meal travels 1,400 miles from farmer to table. What's going to happen when the price of fossil fuels increases? And what's going to happen in times of climate change? You definitely want to relocalize your food economy. And, you know, in that, reducing the carbon footprint of your food economy is a significant part of beginning to mitigate climate change. This is my cool squash that I grow. I was first given the seeds, and I was told that they came out of an archaeological dig near Green Bay, Wisconsin, and that they had been in a clay ball. And then they broke up with that clay ball and they had these seeds in them, and they said that they carbon dated that, 800 years old. You know, there's like 2,400 seeds in each one, and so we kept sharing them. And so people send me pictures of them with this squash. Now all around, it's kind of like having grandchildren or something. And people ask me what that squash was called. And I was like, well, white guys name stuff all the time. And y'all know that's true. White guys are busy naming things. They gotta name everything, right? Clark Fork or whatever the heck that is. Like, they name it after themselves, they name it after whatever, right? There's all, this whole country's named like that. So I was like, well, I'm gonna name that squash. So I named that squash. Anenasquash gete okosaman, which means really cool old squash. Yep. And how you know you've arrived is that if you look at the Baker Seed Catalog, which is called the Whole Seed Catalog, has anybody ever seen that catalog? It's kind of like the seed porn catalog. Like, we all look at that and we're like, we are in that catalog. We are in that catalog. That's how you know you've arrived. It's called Gete Okosaman. I was like, there we go. And then this is what I do. My favorite project is my hemp. So I'm a hemp farmer. I have for 3 years had a permit from the state of Minnesota to grow industrial hemp. I can't grow anything with THC in it. My primary interest is in fiber hemp. And this is my hemp skirt. Minnesota used to have 11 hemp mills. We used to grow our clothes. We had a whole economy based on it. And I just want it back. You know, so I've been working on it for a couple of years, and this is our hemp crop from this last year. A couple of my sons, some of my relatives and nephews. This one kid on the far right is a bell rock from Crow. I just want to let you know, we got one of your kids out there on my res, and he's in the hemp field. But it has 3 times the tensile strength of cotton, twice as much production per acre as cotton. An average shirt and jeans takes 5,000 gallons of water if it's made of cotton. Hemp does not have the same water requirements. Right, you can build houses. It's like a very versatile crop. I'm really interested in the future in hemp, and Winona's Hemp is working on a new project to build a hemp mill. I found a mill, and the mill that I'm building on my reservation next to the rail line, the mill is kind of like that Johnny Cash song, One Piece at a Time. You know, I'm talking about that Johnny Cash song. He gets the car and he puts it together one piece at a time, right? So my mill has all these pieces from vintage mills. That cool or what? Yeah, so stay tuned. We're hoping to have one of the first operating hemp mills in our neck of the woods for sure, a textile mill. And this is my wild rice. That's what we're fighting for, to protect. That's the lake that they would have put that pipeline by. But as we think of how to protect that same rice that my ancestors for 8,000 years have harvested on that lake, my tribe, at the end of December of 2018, passed the rights of wild rice, or the rights of Manoman, as a part of our tribal government. I just want to say that in the big picture, there's a couple other tribes. The Poncas have passed the rights of nature. The Ho-Chunk Nation is looking at the rights of nature. But my tribe passed the rights of wild rice, recognizing wild rice has a right to live uncontaminated, has a right to regeneration, has a right to be free of genetic contamination or genetic engineering, has a right to exist, because we are people who are born of wild rice. It's a part of our migration story, and it is our most sacred food. And so where we have a legal set of legal institutions that have upheld the rights of corporations over the rights of people, what you have is the counter to that. And the more enlightened practice, not only of tribes, but of countries like Bolivia and Ecuador and Aotearoa or New Zealand, which have recognized the rights of nature. My tribe has done that, and I say that because legal systems are not stagnant. There was a time when I and every other Black or Native person wasn't actually considered a person under the law in this country. Legal institutions will evolve. But as I said at the beginning, the rights of Mother Earth and the rights of nature, the rights of our beings, is not something that the United States is familiar with in its legal canons that came from papal law and dominion. And so it is time to look beyond legal canons to indigenous legal canons and the knowledge of other nations like Bolivia, which declared almost a decade ago the rights of Mother Earth. Kind of in closing, I found this quote. There's a group out on Pine Ridge called the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation. I was reading their annual report a couple of years ago, and I said, that's powerful what you guys said there. And so I call up my friend Nick Tilson, one of my nephews. He used to run Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation, really a remarkable initiative on Pine Ridge Reservation to transform that community near Kyle. And I said, hey, Nick, can I use this quote? I'm writing something. He's like, yeah, auntie, yeah, but let me just tell you where that quote came from. A bunch of us were going into sweat. He said, and a bunch of Oglalas is what he's talking about. We were going into sweat. And he said, and we was talking, and we were kind of talking smack. Even sometimes when you're off to be your sacred being, you're still talking smack on the way in. So they're doing that, he said, and then we went in the lodge, and then he said, this spirit came into the sweat lodge. This is what he said. He said, this spirit came into the sweat lodge, and this is what that spirit said. How long are you going to let others determine the future for your children? Are we not warriors? When our ancestors went into battle, they did not know what the consequences were going to be. All they knew is that if they did nothing, things would not go well for their children. Do not operate out of a place of fear. Operate out of a place of hope. Because with hope, everything is possible. The time is now, the movement is here. And that's what that spirit told those guys. And so in this moment where we have this opportunity to look out for our descendants, as our ancestors looked out for us, and as they looked and wondered what would happen, they thought about 7 generations from now. They thought about how they could care not only for themselves, but for their relatives, whether they had wings or fins or roots or paws. They thought about how they could reaffirm their covenant and make things right. You know, and in the big picture, there's a lot of crazy stuff we have done as humans. They call this the Anthropocene era now, because we are like the dominant force in changing ecology. But someplace in that, we must remember how beautiful we are. And I think about that because corn in itself tells you that story. Corn does not exist in nature. In nature, it is teosinte. It is teosinte. But it is the hands and prayers of individuals who collected and saved seeds and thought that made 8,000 varieties of corn. It made it of all those colors. Corn is one of those wondrous beings that is our relationship and our covenant to that natural world. And so we are here in this moment. What a great spiritual opportunity we have to not have historical or ecological amnesia and to remember this moment we have and to be the people that our descendants can be proud of. Miigwech, thank you for your time.
Thank you.